and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. I'm the co-host, Mark Ames. The day today is June 10th, 2017, and this is episode 88. I'm on the line now with the Warnerd, Gary Butcher, a.k.a. John Dolan in Italy, and we have a great guest today, Elijah Magnier, the chief correspondent for Al Rai, to talk about Syria and Iraq. First, John, can you hear me? How you doing?
I'm fine. It's finally gotten hot in Turin. We had, I don't know if we've mentioned this on the show before, but we had an actual, I suppose, irregular war-related episode in Turin when, after a big game by Juventus, the local team, there was a stampede in one of the main plazas in Turin because people heard someone say, apparently, I'm a kamikaze in Italian, and it was just some drunk teenager, but they took it very seriously, and some people were actually hurt.
Well, yeah, that's pretty scary. So, but you guys weren't in the area. I remember seeing that, and people, the initial reports were that it there possibly wasn't, you know, an Islamic State terrorist there. And I thought, oh my God, right next to where you're living. But anyway, yeah, it was just people are jittery.
No, there was nothing as far as I know. It was just a moment of panic. I mean, there have been, as far as I know, no bombs in Italy. If there are, I don't think they were very big.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think I want to get as quickly to our interview as possible because we have with us on the line Elijah Magnier, the chief correspondent for Al Rai. And Elijah, you're in Damascus right now, right? And you just got in from Baghdad?
Yes, hello, Mark. Thank you very much for having me. Yes, I am. I just arrived from Baghdad yesterday evening, and I am in Damascus today.
Uh-huh. So how long were you in Baghdad, and what were you... Were you covering the battle up in Mosul or just everything there? Or?
Yes, I've been in Baghdad for the last 5 days, and I've just went to Mosul, and I went along the Syrian-Iraqi borders with the PMU, Iraqi security forces, who are just taking all the part of West Mosul and advancing toward the most important area, which is the meeting area between the Syrian and the Iraqis close to Al-Qaim. That was the aim, really.
Mm-hmm. That was kind of a, because the way the Warnerd also has been describing how ISIS works over the years is sort of just constantly moving back and forth like an organism. Like if you attack them here, they have this long, particularly along the Euphrates River, but throughout the desert as well, these sort of long stretches where they can move. And it seems like this time they're really working to cut them off everywhere and finish them.
That is true. That's the aim, because ISIS has been the weakest link and the weakest force in Syria, not in Iraq, but in Syria. Therefore, when the Iraqi put themselves together and managed to create what is called the Popular Mobilization Unit, it's almost around between 60, 70 to 90,000 men. They managed to start recovering province after province until they reach Mosul, which is not the last battle because they still have other areas that are important, like, for example, Hawija. And all along the border with the Syrian border, particularly the areas of Al-Qaim, Ana, Rawa, these are really strongholds of ISIS. But yes, ISIS is pushed away, is losing its territory, but it's not going to disappear, unfortunately. The same is happening in Syria.
There are so many things we want to ask you, because I hope our listeners are familiar with Elijah Magnier's work, but if you're not, he's been one of the most reliable commentators on this Iraq-Syria war for a very long time. And it's been pretty easy to tell over the past 5 years who gets it right and who gets it wrong. And and you've consistently gotten it right. So I'm hoping we can ask you about many things which are not yet really well understood by most people outside the region. So I encourage listeners to go to Al-Rai, a Kuwait-based site where Elijah is chief correspondent. We're going to be asking you about some of your recent stories from Al-Rai. One is called ISIS Dropping as Fast as It Grew in 2014. So I'd like to start with what happened.
I'm sorry to cut you off real quickly, but also to Elijah's blog, English language blog. Elijah, what's the address for that again? Because there you can find all your articles in English collected.
I really have a very bad memory.
You know what? I have it right here. So I just found it. First of all, just type in Elijah Magnier. The last name is Magnier. And it's ElijahJM.wordpress.com. Anyway, John, go ahead.
So I wonder if you could take us through the remarkable series of reversals in Iraq over the past 3 years. In the summer of 2014, the Iraqi army, which had been the object of a tremendous investment by the Americans, simply collapsed when subjected to Islamic State pressure. And it seemed like it was one of the most hopeless forces, one of the most corrupt and demoralized forces in the world. And it's pretty clear that it's come back very strongly. And you mentioned the PMU as one of the factors in that. Can you explain how the Iraqi army has managed to become so much better?
Yes. So in 2014, when the Sunni tribe took Mosul, which is actually, there's a slight correction here for the history. It is not ISIS who took Mosul. The ISIS guys were a few hundred. It is a combination of several Sunni tribes that came from Anbar, that came from the Nineveh province, which Mosul is part of it. And they all came together against the city of Mosul, supported by many regional countries, mainly Turkey, Saudi Arabia. And that the main aim was to really defeat the central government of Baghdad and send a strong message to the Americans that you have removed a Sunni leader, that is Saddam Hussein, and replaced him by the Shia leader, and at that time was Nouri al-Maliki. And the response was, it is better to divide Iraq and give a federation to the Kurds, another part to the Sunni, and another part to the Shia. And that was really the message. And this is when, in 2014, all the countries around Iraq called what today we call ISIS, they called the Sunni Revolution, to the point that Turkey left 50 diplomats in their embassy or consulate in Mosul. And these were not removed because they were all involved in this kind of revolution. And the Iraqi army, as you rightly said, didn't have the ideology and the incentive to defend the country that was devastated by corruption. And the people who were responsible of Mosul and the protection of Mosul, including Nujaifi, who was the governor, they were all corrupted. And this helped the Sunni tribes to take over Mosul. And this is where ISIS, with its brutality, moved in and started beheading people, imposing the Sharia, imposing the law. We heard at that time the Naqshbandi group was much stronger than ISIS. But then they just vanished away because they had no choice either to join ISIS, like all the other tribes, or to just leave. And this is where ISIS took the lead, and all the people who were involved in defeating the Iraqi army at that time were the Sunni who were angry with the Baghdad government, the injustice that was replayed. I mean, the Sunni injustice exerted by Saddam Hussein against the Shia was replaced by the Shia injustice against the Sunni. And this is why all the tribes contributed in Anbar, in Nineveh, to defeat the forces of the Iraqi government. And this is where ISIS took the advantage and then took the lead, and everything became ISIS. Mm.
So basically, they had the most kind of radical, coherent ideology. And in situations like this, groups like that really mean nasty, and ideologically coherent groups tend to win out over the other ones. So they wound up just absorbing or kicking out everybody who wasn't with them. Is that, that's what happened? And turn it into...
Yes, this is exactly what happened. Plus, they had the power of finance. They were mm-hmm. not only financed by the countries of the region, but they took control of all the oil in the area of Anbar, and they were trying to advance toward Kirkuk to take the city of Kirkuk, that is the richest and right. That contained the largest reserve of oil. So therefore, they had enough money to buy or to pay for the tribes or to control the tribes and to increase and recruit and increase their number. And there were tens of thousands. I mean, there were only the foreign fighters were estimated between 35 to 45,000 fighters.
Wow. So, and the money came from the Saudis, from Qatar, from Turkey. Is that right?
Yes. At the very beginning, all the money came from the regional countries, mainly Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and Turkey offered the logistic and the support and the influence, because as we well know, the city of Tal Afar, that is just west of Mosul, is a Turkmen city. So they have a very strong, the Turks have a very strong influence in the north of Iraq. And all this combination together supported ISIS, but not under the name of ISIS at that time. They mm-hmm. supported the Sunni against the Shia government.
Mm-hmm. So to get back to John's question again, then what changed on this, you know, the Shia-led Iraqi government side, where they were able to put together a you know, quite capable, it turns out, fighting force that had a higher morale? Is it the actual Iraqi army? Is it the PMU? And can you also tell us a little bit about the PMU?
Okay, so I was in Iraq at that time when ISIS took Mosul, and I saw the panic in Baghdad and in the south of Iraq. And to tell you honestly, the reason why ISIS didn't manage to occupy the south of Iraq, I think because they didn't have enough gasoline to drive to the south.
I see.
But otherwise, everybody was running away. People of Baghdad were just running away, leaving the city, going south or traveling to other countries of the Middle East, because they just believe ISIS is going to just knock their door and just be in front of them. So what happened is, because the cities of Karbala and Najaf are two holy cities for the Shia, mm-hmm. the religious leadership that we call the Marja'iyah, which is the reference, it means the leadership, saw the danger of this organization and really believed that ISIS is going to drive to Baghdad and to take Karbala and Najaf, the two main holy cities of the entire Shia around the world. Therefore, they called what was called the Grand Ayatollah Sistani, who is mm-hmm. one of the leaders of the Shia Islamic sect, called for the general mobilization of the population and asked them to carry arms and to join the security forces that were completely dismantled at that time and just running away, and to form a popular front to face ISIS and to stop ISIS. Now, something just to be said, the Anbar province, which is a stronghold of ISIS, is linked at the limit of the city of Karbala, that is one of the holiest city for the Shia in Iraq. Mm. And therefore, they saw the danger as really immediate. And the media at that time was just talking about how the Iraqi army was running away. And there were information that were fake information every day, just rumors that ISIS has reached the airport of Baghdad. They're just coming in and they occupy the west of Baghdad. And they reach Abu Ghraib. And all these news were just feeding the fear of the population. And this is where the popular mobilization units were formed and were trained mainly and first of all by the Iranians, because the Americans refused to run for help for a very specific reason. First of all, the at the time of Barack Obama, the prime minister, the Iraqi prime minister al-Maliki, asked the Americans to leave the country to end their mandate in 2011. And the Americans didn't want to leave such a country where there is, first, a lot of oil, second, bordering Syria and Iran, and third, it's quite a good base in the Middle East to establish themselves. Therefore, to be asked to leave and to leave the place to the Iranians was not a very good idea. Therefore, it was an opportunity for the American administration to see more Iraq on its knees and perhaps divide Iraq. The Kurds were ready to declare the partition of the country. ISIS represented the Sunnis, so why not give them a state as long as they don't represent a danger to the American national security, which they don't, and they didn't at that time. And the Shia will have a small state. Therefore, Iran will not be able to have a sub-country to rely upon and to increase its strength against our ally, which is the West ally, that is Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf countries. Therefore, the Americans didn't run to help the Iranians, to help the Iraqis, sorry. And Iran, out of its own protection, because if Iraq falls, then Iran is next on the list.
Quite cynical.
ISIS was already in Syria. Sorry. Yes.
I just said it's, you know, it's quite cynical, but that's how it goes. Yeah.
Yeah. So Iran was next on the line. So for the Iranian, it was a question of protecting the Iraqis, but also defend their country. Therefore, it's better to fight in other people's land than in their land. And they went to Iraq and they supported Iraq, but they didn't have the enough military capability, or perhaps the most important is the air force, to defeat ISIS as fast as they wanted to. So they worked on the infantry and they worked on the military to reorganize, but above all, to inject a kind of ideology enough to face ISIS ideology. You can't face ISIS by a man who is just paid a salary at the end of the month. You need someone who thinks like an ISIS militant, but the opposite, to be able to fight and have no fear of death. And this is the Shia doctrine versus the Sunni doctrine that were confronted in Iraq and were able to stop ISIS from advancing. But it doesn't mean to conquer all the territory that ISIS managed to take hold of in 2014, 2015.
So when ISIS led the Sunni tribes into Mosul, they were working together, but ISIS had occupied the city for, I guess, almost 3 years by the time it was finally under attack. Would you say that the tribes which helped ISIS take Mosul still support ISIS, or has there been division?
At that time, the tribe supported ISIS, but thanks to ISIS doing, the tribe gave up on ISIS, because what ISIS did after 2014, 2015, they believed they are the strongest force and they can control everything, and they didn't. Luckily, they didn't imitate what Al-Qaeda promotes, is to win the heart and minds. In fact, what Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of Al-Qaeda, who replaced Osama bin Laden, sent a message to al-Zarqawi when he was, before he was killed,
right,
by asking him to win Heart and Mind and telling him the Shia were never exterminated throughout the history. Just concentrate on the Americans rather than the Shia. And luckily, ISIS didn't follow Al-Qaeda kind of wisdom in insurgency and in approaching the community they live in. And they started to behave rather brutally against anyone who opposed them, who didn't think like them, and mainly among the Sunnis, because the Sunnis in Iraq, they found themselves with all their cities completely destroyed because ISIS was occupying the Sunni cities. And because ISIS was occupying the Sunni cities, not the Shia cities or the Kurd cities, apart from few Kurdish cities, of course, in the north. So the whole battle went to take place in Sunnis' home, in Sunnis' cities. And the Sunnis in Iraq are completely devastated today, and they suffer the most in their wealth, in their life. In, they've lost everything because Sunni came and occupied their city. So they've understood that. They saw what happened in Anbar. They saw what's happening in every city ISIS is attacked, because the artillery need to just clear the road to the infantry when there are no civilians living in, which is completely the opposite of what's happening today in Mosul. And therefore, the artillery have no problem in just burning the ground completely and burning the ground so ISIS can't keep hold of the territory. It means destroying everything to reduce the human casualties when attack, when a force is attacking. Therefore, right, the tribes understood that hosting ISIS is just brought destruction and misery to them. And ISIS doesn't have any more a society that can contain them, generally speaking.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So would you, so this is, I think the tribal structure of Sunni Iraq is something a lot of us don't understand very well. So this holds for the urban population as well. I think a lot of us have the idea that the tribal structure is strong in the rural areas of Anbar, but it might not be strong in the Sunni cities. But would you say it holds there too?
I think the entire Iraqi community is made of tribes. And they are tribes that are kind of intertwined among themselves. And there are Sunni and Shia who are married together, and they form, there are tribes that are a mixture of Sunni and Shia. And Iraq is dominated by tribes, is ruled by tribes. Therefore, you have the Mutayr, the Dulaim, the Sulaib, the Harb. There are many tribes who control the country and are the majority. And a big part of these tribes exist, exactly the same tribes in Syria and in the north of Lebanon. Therefore, right, it's a community that is made of tribe, and it's quite strong in Iraq.
Yes, one thing that's come through in what you're saying now and in what I've read of your work is an implication, I think, that you think Islamic State will fight to the bitter end in Iraq, but is willing to withdraw in large parts of Syria. Is that correct?
The way ISIS fights in Iraq and in Syria, depending who's fighting ISIS first, but when they are faced with the Kurds, when they are faced with Sunni, when they are faced with the Americans, normally what they do is they see if there is no use of such a battle, at the exception of Kobane and Al-Arab in Syria, where they fought to the last man, and they didn't understand that that was a lost battle. So what they do normally is the Americans leave always a way for ISIS to withdraw, and because occupying the territory and recovering the territory is very important, which is true in the military knowledge. Therefore, whenever ISIS feels cornered and the resistance is no longer possible, they pull out. And what they are doing today is they've lost the northeast, and they going now. They are pushed in the Syrian semi-desert, and they are in Raqqa, surrounded from three sides, not from the north. Not from the south, where they can still pull out toward Deir ez-Zor, that is completely surrounded, and where the Syrian army is in that city, and they can go toward Abu Kamal and Al-Qa'im on the borders, where this is one of the biggest ISIS stronghold in Syria and Iraq that people don't speak about because they don't know the geography, I think.
Yes. Now, this is something I'm really eager to talk to you about. I'm not sure whether it's Atanaf or Atanf. There's something very strange going on in southern Syria, right where Syria, Jordan, and Iraq share a border. The United States is apparently trying to build yet another Free Syrian Army or moderate Sunni militia, and it seems to be willing to protect that with air power, because several times it's attacked advancing forces moving towards that area. Can you tell us what the U.S. plan in that area seems to be?
Yes, sure. The area that starts from the south of Syria, the province of Suwayda and Daraa, up north, going up to Al-Hasaka, all this area was under the control, more or less, by Al-Qaeda, the Syrian rebels, and ISIS. So what happened is, after the Astana-Kazakhstan meeting between the Russian, the Iranian, the Turks, and some of the rebel groups supported by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, they have agreed on a kind of a ceasefire in most of the areas under the Al-Qaeda and rebel control. And because they have agreed, it's a recognition to accept the presence of the Turks in the north of Syria, and to accept their control of a large part of the north, because Turkey is one of the main player in Syria, and Turkey was in charge of keeping Al-Qaeda and the rebels under their control to make sure that they will not create more havoc, and they will keep calm until the main battle against ISIS will be over. So therefore, because of this kind of a ceasefire was established, the Syrian army and the Russians and their allies in Syria, Iran and Hezbollah and Iraqi militia, they all moved their forces and injected an additional 20,000 men. This is a private information that haven't been published yet, inside this battle, and to be able to run and to create a kind of a race who's going to control the main part of ISIS territory, because ISIS is the weakest link and the weakest force in Syria. And because ISIS is the weakest force, you can see the Syrian army managed to occupy 20,000 square kilometers in 3 weeks. That's twice the size of Lebanon, and that twice the size of Belgium, just in 3 weeks. Because they're walking in this area, fighting ISIS from time to time wherever there's an ISIS position, but ISIS is just running away. If we remember, in September 2016, the American forces and their allies bombed the Syrian army in the Mount of Tharda, and that overlooked the Deir ez-Zor airport. Deir ez-Zor is a city that has been surrounded since years by ISIS, and is completely surrounded and defended by a small Syrian army force. And the U.S. and coalition air force bombed the Syrian army for several hours.
By accident, right?
By accident, yes. By accident for several hours, causing over 100 killed. And this is where ISIS, on the same day, moved in and controlled the mountain that is extremely important and strategic. And they neutralized the airport Therefore, the supply of weapons, ammunition, and all the necessities of several hundred thousand of the civilians surrounded in the city stopped suddenly. And this has gave the upper hand to ISIS. And the Americans, of course, apologized for the bombing, but the damage has been done. And the idea was, okay, well, we don't want the Syrian army there. It's better if ISIS control Deir ez-Zor and then we move in and regain it back. So the whole north and northeast of Syria will be under the control. Apparently, the Kurds and the Arab tribes, but mainly the Americans, who established already four military bases in that area, in the northeast of Syria,
in Hasaka,
where they have intention to stay for very long.
Right. In Hasaka, they've been building large bases in Hasaka. Like they mean, yeah, as you say, they mean to stay.
Yes, they meant to stay. So what happened in Tanaf, the way they have done, they went to Tanaf. I mean, the crossing between Damascus and Baghdad at the first beginning of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, 2003 to 2006, we didn't have a way to fly to Baghdad. So we had to go to Damascus and take the car from Damascus to Baghdad. And it took us between 14 and 15 hours drive. Crossing the same as Tanaf border, that is a complete desert. The area just for hundreds of kilometers, there's nobody on the air, on the street. And this at Tanaf area is really insignificant. It's not strategic, but it marks kind of the end of the Syrian semi-desert and the beginning of the north of Syria. And that is more or less at the same level of Palmyra, Tadmor, dividing that area in two. Therefore, when the Americans moved to Tanaf and they said to the Russian and to the Syrian army, you can't come closer than 50 to 60 kilometers, and they put themselves there, it was really not a very intelligent move, I think, because they need to keep this area to control the commerce between Iraq and Syria. Now, nobody is going to cross from Iraq into Syria to cross an area controlled by the Syrian rebels who are sectarian and who have the long history of killing Shia in Syria. Therefore, they're not going to hesitate to kill the Shia in Iraq, and no Iraqi is going to cross that point. So what Damascus did, they said, okay, you want to stay in Tanaf. They've tried three times, and for three times, the American Air Force bombed their forces, Syrian forces on the ground with their allies to just tell them not to come closer. So what they did yesterday, they went a little bit above, and they kept between 50 to 60 kilometers distance from Tanaf, and they closed the road on the Americans and on the rebels between Al-Tanaf, the same height more or less of Palmyra, toward Deir ez-Zor and toward the northeast of Syria. And the message is, you're not going to go to Deir ez-Zor. We're going to liberate these civilian who are surrounded there and the city that's surrounded by ISIS. And you're not going to take the north of Syria. You took the northeast of Al-Hasaka, the area under the control of the Kurds. You are going to take Raqqa. You're not going to enjoy it very much because the Kurds and the Arab tribes in the area are not in great harmony. On the contrary, they can't stick each other. But now they are united because they want to defeat ISIS. So everybody is united to defeat ISIS now. But they're saying to the Americans, sooner or later, you're going to pull out of Tanaf. And they've created another point just above Tanaf, where the Iraqis would be very happy to exchange commerce between their country and Syria. And it is not at all what is talked about and called as a Shia Crescent, because this is a big lie. Mm. just to stop the Shia connected. I mean, we're jumping from one topic to another, but the idea is has been promoted by many so-called analysts and experts that the link between Tehran, Baghdad, Damascus, and Beirut, it has been stopped and cut off on a Tanf border. Now, this is ridiculous because people never traveled to Iraq, to Lebanon by car or by land to supply the axis that is linked from Tehran to Beirut, because there are these days airplane and there are navy and ships that can supply goods and weapons, and certainly not through a very long road that I've done 100 times, and that's very unpleasant, and you have to cross the desert and you have to cross the whole city of Syria, and then you have to go to Lebanon to reach Beirut. It's just ridiculous.
There have been a lot of strange stories out of Tanf, like the one yesterday involved an F-15 shooting down a drone that was supposedly armed. And that has to be one of the most bizarre single combats in the history of the world. An F-15, one of the most advanced firecraft in the world, shooting down what I presume is like a drone that Islamic State was using to defend Mosul, like a commercially bought drone with a hand grenade or a small gravity bomb on it. But there's this idea that it's somehow engaged in a dogfight with the F-15, and that's how it's being reported.
Yes, I mean, ISIS do use these kind of drones. But the area of Tanf is, I mean, the area of Tanf, the whole of Syria is very crowded with drones from all forces operating on the ground. I mean, you really need a traffic light in the air. The Iranians took aerial photos of American fighters, or not American fighters, American drone flying over the Syrian army forces close to Tanf. And the Iranian message is saying, you have drones, we have drones.
Right.
You're watching us and we are watching you. So bringing down a drone by an F-15 or an F-16, it's a kind of just a little messages that go across from one country to another.
One of the things you've mentioned in your stories that I found very impressive is proxy fighting by choosing proxy targets. That is, the U.S. will hit a certain target in order to give a message to someone other than the target. Or, as you said, Turkey will strike the SDF in northern Syria, not so much because it's afraid of the SDF, but to send a humiliating message to the Americans, right?
Yes, that is true. There's always a hidden message in the language in the Middle East. And the Middle East is full of that. So there's just, sometimes they can't send a direct message, so they send it indirectly. When Al-Qaeda is angry with Turkey, they hit the pro-Turkey. And when the Saudis are angry with the Qatar, they create a fight with the Qatar proxies in Syria, which happened yesterday, by the way. So these are always messages and struggle. So in Syria, you only hear the Syrian army that is Syrian. Otherwise, you hear the Qatar proxy Syrian, the Saudi proxy Syrian, the American proxy Syrian, the Turkish proxy Syrian, and so on. So they're all full of proxies, and there are no Syrian, really.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask you about is the Turkey Islamic State relationship. It seemed almost as if there was a falling out between Turkey and Islamic State at some point. And I don't know if this had to do with the Astana conference, with Islamic State feeling sold out, but it seemed as if they were moving pretty freely through Gaziantep and cooperating pretty well. And then
Blowing up Kurds, and then
Islamic State started hitting targets within Turkey. Did something happen there?
Yes. So at the very beginning, Turkey was buying oil from ISIS on the black market, And Turkey was supplying ISIS with all the goods and weapons that ISIS needed for its fight in Syria, like everybody else, because the aim was to remove the Assad regime and change the regime without offering any alternative but a total chaos and divide the country between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So Turkey was happy to allow foreign fighters and ISIS to live in Turkey and live in Syria. And I was corresponding with some of the ISIS fighters at that time during 2014, 2015. And they were asking the ISIS supporters who are traveling to Syria and Iraq, saying, we have enough fighters now. Stay near Turkey. We will need you one day. Find a job. Get married, build a family, build a business, but stay in Turkey. This is where we will need you in the future.
And wow, Turkey, that's remarkable. Yeah,
okay. Yes. And Turkey finds itself with a game that is going to turn against it, exactly as Saudi Arabia, when they supported Al-Qaeda and then ISIS, and these two monsters turned against Saudi Arabia and the rest of the world. Yes, Turkey supplied ISIS with everything they need. Just to give you a small comparison, an Israeli army that is fully equipped with a large warehouse and arsenal could not sustain 30 days of war against Hezbollah in Lebanon and started to scream support from the United States and Great Britain to supply more bombs because they ran out. Now, can you imagine ISIS and Al-Qaeda running a war since 6 years and never running out of weapons and ammunition?
I mean, that's a really good point. I've never heard that put that way before. That's a remarkable point.
Yes. So you can't sustain one battle for 1 month or 2 months without using everything you've got in your warehouses and all the weapons and in the ammunition you have. And can you imagine all these years, everybody is running the war? I mean, I see the ship coming from Russia and from Iran almost every week to support the Syrian army in their fight in the 6 years. I mean, the other side, where on the earth all this weapon is coming and all this ammunition and the quantity? I mean, you have over 100 rebel groups. They all armed and they all have weapons and they all ready to start a new battle, a new campaign with all the name they call it and the codes. And every couple of months they start a new one. This is unbelievable. And nobody's paying attention to where all this is coming from. Of course, it's coming only from Turkey because it's the only logistic place that have access to both Islamic State and Al-Qaeda rebels.
Yeah, it's too embarrassing to have to look into that story. And somehow our media's interest, and when I say our, I mean American and probably British as well, media's interest kind of tracks with where their governments want the interest to be true, because that would be very embarrassing. It turns out a NATO ally and Gulf allies are keeping ISIS alive and well-stocked and Al-Qaeda well-stocked while we're supposedly fighting them at the same time. I mean, it's screwy. It's absolutely screwy. But let me get back again to just to close off the discussion about Al-Tanf on the border there. So it sounds like from what you're saying is, so Islamic State is kind of like the Ottoman Empire's very end. Everybody knows it's going to collapse. It's the sick terrorist, you know, of Syria. And so there's a scramble to grab its land before somebody else does. And the SA and their allies seem to be the ones that have gotten most of the land. And so the Americans with their allies have taken this one area thinking, ha, 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 now we're going to cut off this commercial supply route that's so important to Syria and Iraq. But it sounds like what you said is they just built another basically border crossing. The SA did. They just took a different border crossing further up north and can control that. Plus now they're in a better position to take back Deir ez-Zor. So where does this leave the Americans? What's going to happen? I mean, are they going to try and fight north then at this point, or?
The Americans have no choice but to pull out of Al-Tanf sooner or later, because They have their road cut north. They can't go north. There's no point in staying south where the Syrian rebels and the U.S. proxies are weak. And why I say weak? Because had they been strong enough, they wouldn't need the U.S. Air Force to support them and to interfere every time the Syrian army is advancing toward the Syrian rebel positions. And this is where the Americans are using their air force to stop the advance of the Syrian army toward the rebels, because they are very knowledgeable that the rebels can't defend themselves. You have 4,000 rebels in the entire semi-desert from the south province of Daraa to the north where you reach Tanaf. This is a huge area where there are around 40,000 Syrian army members and their allies operating. And what do you want to do with 4,000 in a vast area that is a huge territory? They just disappear.
And the past attempts to train moderate Sunni Syrian rebels by the U.S. have been pretty disastrous. They have not fought well. They've often sold their weapons. So one thing we've seen in talking to American military people who've served in Syria is there seems to be a kind of revolt of the lower ranks with them, that there's a powerful interest in regime change at any cost, especially from the CIA, but from other parts of the security state. But a lot of the military people who get that job don't seem to like it and don't want to do it.
Well, I think President Trump now, he has managed to collect enough money. I mean, the $480 billion investment from the Saudis, if we calculate that every 50 rebels needs $500 million to be trained, and therefore you can train a few hundred rebels with all this money. So, well, look, regime change is no longer possible because it's very clear. Regime change in Iraq didn't work. And what the same Barack Obama said, ISIS is a result of the U.S. invasion to Iraq. And from we had a small organization called Al-Qaeda in Iraq that turned to be a monster that became ISIS attacking everywhere around the world. And the change of regime in Libya created a catastrophe. And today, the change of regime in Syria was just about to create another big problem for the entire Middle East and Europe, particularly not the United States, because the United States is a bit far. So changing regime is really not a very good idea. On the contrary, it's playing with people's lives and destiny. And it is not a question of, okay, we keep the problem in the Middle East like that. They are busy with one another and they don't come to us. That's very cynical, because we know they are able to learn and to become very clever and intelligent and export their problems to every single city around the world. And this is what ISIS is doing. It has, through the internet, the ideology is traveling across all borders without any boundaries. This is a very risky game the Americans are doing with these people who have a very strong ideology, and they love to die and kill. They don't care about life.
This gets into something you wrote about Hezbollah and the Israelis, that the Israelis, and John, the Warner, has talked about and written about this a lot too, but the Israelis obviously fear above all Hezbollah and Iran. Hezbollah, they lost, you know, as you've talked about, the war with Hezbollah in 2006. And they don't seem to fear and seem to be fine with, and maybe even have a kind of a strange relationship with Al-Qaeda and Islamic State groups in the Sunni radicals in Syria. But you wrote about how these people are, particularly the Al-Qaeda groups there, are learning to fight. And the idea that you can just dismiss them forever or coddle them is kind of insane as well.
Well, look, you're right what you're saying, because what the Israelis can't see is they can't see on the long term, on the long future. We saw the evolution of Hezbollah throughout the years, and Hezbollah became very experienced fighters. But Hezbollah are linked to a country in Lebanon where they are part of the parliament, part of the government, and part of the society that is trying to show its power as an organization with a lot of weapons to tell the Israelis, don't attack us. This is what we have, and this is what we're going to use. We don't want the war. While with ISIS and with Al-Qaeda is a completely different game. Al-Qaeda, they have adopted what is called the policy of tamkin, which means you wait until you become stronger and you control the land and you control the society and you have the support of the society and you have enough power to start your next phase. And Al-Qaeda has used drone in Syria. They used artillery like any classical army. The people who walked in Tal al-Is, they saw 1,220 howitzer cannon that are aligned like any classical army that start an attack with a bombardment and then the advance of a troop. These are not savages, as people think. They are not disorganized. On the contrary, they use a remote control tanks today, and they fill it up with explosive, and they send it first, and they advance immediately afterward. And they have drones filming every step. They use the media very effectively. They use their forces in the places after planning, having a good military plan of attack. And they know where to attack. They know where are the weakest point of their enemy. These are very trained people. If we look at ISIS contained most of the generals that were kicked out by Paul Bremer, and they all joined ISIS. And these are generals of the Iraqi army. They are people who know how to fight and are people who study in the West and the East military school, and they know how to plan attacks and they know how to plan overseas attack. Look at the attack in Iran. We saw a video sent by the terrorists inside the parliament while they are attacking, and ISIS publishing it and diffusing the video during the attack. That is an unbelievable coordination. Yeah. We saw, these people are not stupid, and we're feeding them, we're supporting them, we call for a regime change. And you mentioned the embarrassing for the media. I mean, one feels embarrassed if he feels shame. There's no shame in the mainstream media because they just, what they said when I've been talking to some journalists, some colleague, mainly from the Washington Post, and they say, we follow the policy of the newspaper. I mean, there's a big difference between being a professional and report the reality and just report what the newspaper wants, to the point that journalists sitting in New York breaking news about Syria when they have never been in Syria, or they become activists and they report information from activists on the ground with an agenda as a fact, and they just pass it on to the public. This is a scandal.
It is. It's terrible. It's the easiest thing to do for a journalist because you don't have to fight the government on it. You don't have to fight your editor on it, because there's this general consensus in Washington that these are good guys and these are bad guys. And if you actually go there and report and start to see that it's different, and then you want to get that into your newspaper, you know, you might get it in, but you're going to have to argue with your editor who just is, you know, drinking martinis with his government, contacts. And you're going to have to work harder. And, unfortunately, the higher up you go in the mainstream journalism world, just the more hackish and careerist these people are, which is why it's so great to talk with you. I mean, I still have a million questions. And one of the things I want to get into as well is, you've talked about Qatari-backed rebels versus Saudi-backed rebels. And, obviously the spat between the bad blood between Qatar and Saudi Arabia has been something that's gone on for a while, and it's developed. So it didn't just, it kind of exploded out of the blue, but it's been there for a while. But I remember when there was that horrible bombing of the Shia children at Rashidin during the exchange of the Shia villagers from
Fuad and Freya. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, and the Sunnis from Zabadani and Madaya.
Yes.
I remember you were pointing out, actually, I think even to me on social media, you know, look, not even within these jihadi groups, not all of them are on the same page. They can kind of switch allegiances between each other. That exchange went on under in a larger kind of deal brokered between Qatar and Iran and the Syrians, I suppose, and the Iraqis who had been holding those Qatari bustard hunters. And then, of course, somebody blew them all up. And the first thought is, well, maybe the Saudis did. You know, seeing what happened later, maybe it was the Saudi proxies who went after the Qatari proxies. I mean, is that connected at all to what's gone on since? Or was that a symptom of what's been going on? What happened with Qatar and Saudi Arabia?
The problem with Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the whole rebel in Syria is when there is a deal between the Syrian government and any other party, the Syrian government's answer and request, demand, and negotiation is straightforward. They want or they don't want. You have one answer, one government is responding. On the other side, you have the Egyptian proxy, the Qatar proxy, the Riyadh proxy, the Turkish proxy. You have all kinds of proxies, the American proxies. And these, they don't have the same view. They don't have the same agenda. They don't have the same objectives. Therefore, when the exchange of the cities of Madaya, Zabadani versus Fuad and Kefreya, the exchange was very simple and straightforward. The government guaranteed the security of those willing to leave Madaya and Kefreya, Madaya and Zabadani. And by the way, only a few thousand left and the rest remained. And they refused to leave their home, and they wanted to stay under the control, under the government control. And versus Fuad and Kefreya, where the negotiation took an awful lot of time, and only due Qatar's hostages that were taken in Iraq, that the exchange deal was possible. And this is where Qatar used its influence with Al-Qaeda. And this influence has been used several times. I can just give you a quick two. One, when the United Nations forces were kidnapped on the borders by Al-Qaeda, and Qatar paid money to release them. And another one, when the nun of Maalula were kidnapped by Al-Qaeda, and Qatar paid the money and created an exchange with the Lebanese authority. So this time also Qatar intervened and paid money to Al-Qaeda to create this exchange. Now, this exchange on the way between Fuad and Kefreya to Aleppo, you have 150 kilometers that are the most dangerous 150 kilometers because they are controlled by many groups. So what happened is within Al-Qaeda itself, you have people who are very pro-ISIS within Al-Qaeda, and you have a group that was formed very recently called Jund al-Malahim. And these ones are the Muhajirin, the foreign fighters, who have been collected from Jund al-Aqsa, from ISIS, from all the other group who pretend not to be ISIS, but they are the most radical among Al-Qaeda that exists in Idlib. Therefore, when the first day of the exchange took place and the convoy was stopped at the limit of Aleppo, another bomber with a car drove in and called all the children to come and collect some chips and some food because they were waiting for 2 days at the crossing. This is when he was able to create the largest number of victims, really. And the second day, just to confirm the radicals among the radicals, Al-Qaeda kept the exchange secret, the time of exchange secret, and they did it all by night, and they closed all the roads until the second convoy leaving Fuad and Kefreya reached Aleppo and the exchange was possible. So therefore, you have a lot of extremely radical, more radical than the extremely radical. We don't know how to call them anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And you have no unified command.
I don't have any unified command. That's correct.
I've heard estimates of, at one time, of up to 1,200 different militias operating in Syria. And yes, as you say, when you talk to one side, you do get at least a unitary answer, which explains why Syrian religious minorities are reluctant to cooperate, because they don't know from day to day who they'll be dealing with. And that brings us to another question I wanted to ask you about Idlib. Most of the Sunni militias in Syria, other than Islamic State, the biggest area they hold now is the pocket around Idlib. It's a strange landlocked pocket, surrounded, as far as I know, surrounded by the Syrian army at this point, maybe the SDF in the north. What do you think will happen with Idlib? Will it be a stable statelet, or will it dissolve?
This is a very good question. For the time being, Idlib is part of the deal between Russia, Iran, and Turkey to be left unattacked. And that is, the Russian used to bombard Idlib on a regular basis. And the deal was to spare Idlib until the area of Sarakib, where it goes east of Idlib, east-south of Idlib, all this area is part of the deconflict zone and is not to be attacked. Now, what happened is, because of that, Idlib used to be occupied by around 1 million civilians. Today, because of the ceasefire, there is another 1 million at least that migrate from Turkey, who used to be a refugee in Turkey, and move to Idlib and the ruler Idlib to stay there because there is a kind of a ceasefire. Now, the problem within Idlib itself, there are two main groups. We're not going to mention the 150 other groups because it's a waste of time. So there are two main groups. There is Al-Qaeda under different name, changing their name from Nusra to now they are called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. And there is Ahrar al-Sham. The Ahrar al-Sham are 100% faithful to Turkey, and they have a very good relationship with Qatar. And they are between Salafi and Muslim Brotherhood. And they have foreign fighters among them. They are not moderate rebels, on the contrary, but they are a little bit less extreme than the most extreme Al-Qaeda. Right. And Ahrar al-Sham decided to stay, to keep quiet and take a neutral position and not create an infighting against the strongest group, that is Al-Qaeda, in Idlib. So when these two giants meet, they talk, and sometimes Al-Qaeda attacked Ahrar al-Sham, and Ahrar al-Sham solved the matter peacefully to avoid any clash. Otherwise, the whole of city of Idlib will be destroyed by these two, because they are the strongest, and they have between 20 to 30,000 fighters each. Mm-hmm. Therefore, what's happening today is we all believe that what is going to happen in Idlib is the same population of Idlib is not going to like the behavior of Al-Qaeda when they're going to see in other part of the country the kind of life the Syrian will start living. We're not talking about the religion minority, because in Idlib and Al-Qaeda accept only Syrian Sunni living under their control. All the rest of atheists, Shia, Alawi, Kurds, Sunni, and the majority of Syria are Sunni, and 70% of the Syrians are Sunni. Therefore, 70% of the Syrian army are Sunni too. It is not a sectarian war. So what's happening in it, what's going to happen in Idlib, is going to be a city left under the control of Al-Qaeda and Ahrar al-Sham, and they will end up fighting each other, or the society will end up not rejecting most of their doing. They can't keep their radical approach and the radical Islamic behavior with a population that used to live with a sort of freedom and the freedom of religion, at least. And they at least can smoke a cigarette. Where under Al-Qaeda, they can't.
This is sort of like what precipitated the you know, whatever success that the surge had in Iraq in 2006 and 2007 was because you sort of let Al-Qaeda run the Sunni triangle for a while. Everyone winds up turning against them because they're such awful rulers. And once everyone turns against them, it's easier then to expel them.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. I see.
Okay. So the one last question. I know we've kept you more than an hour. I'm sorry about that. But one last question. The next enclave in Syria that we'd like to ask you about is Rojava. I mean, you've said, and I quote, Turkey will not accept the growing strength of the Kurds in Syria and is prepared for subversive military action against America in the Levant. So given that Turkey will presumably not accept the existence of a Kurdish state called Rojava in Syria along the Turkish border, what do you think will happen?
Turkey moved between Al-Hasaka province and Afrin in the northeast and northwest of Syria. And the reason why Turkey moved in from Jarablus to Al-Bab is to cut this Rojava federation and to prevent the Turks, Kurds from having their own kind of independency. Now, what's going to happen is the Kurds will be under the control of the Americans, and the Americans will try to do with the Syrian Kurds what they have done with the Iraqi Kurds, with the difference that the Syrian Kurds are Syrian, are part of Syria, and they're not hostile to the Syrian government, because they are not all of them united in one area. They are in the northwest in Afrin, just north of Aleppo, and there's a big part also around Aleppo city itself. Therefore, the Kurds are survival people, and they don't want to have a problem with anyone surrounding them. And in fact, when the city of Fuan Kifraya was surrounded, the Kurds on the border of the city were supplying these two cities. Nubul and Zahra, sorry. Afrin was supplying Nubul and Zahra with what they needed. Therefore, I don't think the Kurds will have their Rojava as long as Turkey is there. Turkey will try to disturb any Kurds' stability, because they don't want the Kurds in Turkey to ask for an independency. They consider the YPG as a same part of the PKK that are considered terrorist organization by Turkey. And the weird thing is the Americans, who consider the PKK as terrorists, support the Kurds in the north of Syria. And not only that, the Turkey, who considered this PKK as terrorist and the YPG as terrorist, they allow the Peshmerga to walk in Turkey and cross Iraq, Turkey, to go into Kobani and help the Kurds. So don't look for the logic.
It sounds like you're suggesting that there's a possibility that now that regime change is off the menu, many Syrian Kurds would be willing to accept federal status within a reunified or partly reunified Syria. Do you think that's possible?
Well, look, what the Americans did, they ran immediately to take the north east of Syria, because there is oil there and there is water, the Euphrates, and there is oil. Therefore, this area can have a kind of independency and kind of autonomy if it is run and administrated by the Americans. What the Americans are missing is the majority in the area are Arab tribes. And Arab tribes will not accept the overwhelming dominance of the minority of Kurds. Otherwise, we will go back to the same problem of the Middle East. The second is Assad doesn't mind to give the Kurds a kind of independent, a kind of federation, not a dependency, as long as they don't detach themselves from the central government. Now, what's going to happen to the Americans, this is what I really expect, is they're going to face an insurgency from what remained of ISIS, from Al-Qaeda, from Hezbollah, from the Kurds, from the Turks, from everybody, because nobody wants them there, and everybody will run to claim credit for attacking them.
Including their former allies among the Syrian Kurds.
Well, there are Kurds that are part of ISIS, Kurds that are part of Al-Qaeda, Kurds that are part of the Syrian army, Kurds that are pro-Iranians, and Kurds that are pro-Americans. How can you just unite all this mishmash?
Yes. No, I actually worked with a Syrian Kurd in Saudi Arabia who was one of the more fanatically Wahhabi of the people in Saudi Arabia, which is not easy to do.
Yeah. Those who attacked Kobani mainly were Kurds. Kurds attacking Kurds. So ISIS knows very well how to choose the fighters and where to choose them.
Interesting. So they used their own Kurds for the battle in Kobani. I didn't really hear about that much. Interesting. I know we're keeping you, but I'm just still, while we have you, this is such a great interview, and it's so, you know, just clarifying a lot of things. I want to get back to the Qatar-Saudi rift. First of all, when we're talking about Idlib, you know, Al-Qaeda is the strongest force there and the most extreme. And then Ahrar al-Sham would be sort of the second strongest force. And they have somewhat slightly different agendas. Ahrar al-Sham is backed by Turkey and Qatar, as you've talked about, Qatar. But are you saying Al-Qaeda there is backed by the Saudis pretty explicitly, or?
Well, Al-Qaeda is backed by Turkey, is backed by Qatar, and by the Saudis.
So they're just like invest, like venture capitalists. They just invest in these different ones, even jihadi groups that are fighting each other. The same sponsors or investors.
Yeah, well, what we said about Al-Qaeda, it's a very intelligent organization that managed to evolve and to create a kinetic policy throughout the years. So in Syria, the Al-Qaeda was an ISIS commander that was sent to fight and create a base for ISIS in Syria. And this ISIS officer, Abu Muhammad Julani, the head of Al-Qaeda in Syria, turned against his general, let's say, call it like that, it was Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, and created his own net and called himself Al-Qaeda in Syria. Mm-hmm. And throughout the year, it has evolved according to the need of the Syrian arena. And it has changed to say, I'm no longer part of Al-Qaeda, but kept all the Al-Qaeda members within his group and all the foreign fighters. And today saying, I have just a Syrian agenda, therefore I can create a balance. And this is an intelligent move.
It seems to keep the foreign pressure off, right? Like, we are now HTS. We are not going to attack London or New York or Paris. We're totally focused on Syria. And in that case, they could actually draw support from anybody who's still trying to push regime change.
Correct. I fully agree. They're not going to attack overseas because they haven't finished from Syria first. Mm-hmm. But if we look a little bit back, the head of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, called all of Al-Qaeda to migrate to Syria and to go and fight in Syria. And we see the Shura Council, the highest authority around Baghdadi, around Julani, are made of all core Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
And when the Americans are coming to with their drone to kill Al-Qaeda leaders in Syria, they kill all the people around the Julani. So they are very aware this is Al-Qaeda we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And this Al-Qaeda is intelligent enough to change the name. So therefore they're cheating the American law by saying, we under the new name did not declare war against the United States. Therefore you can't put us on the terrorist list. And we have a Syrian agenda. We're not going to attack you. But meanwhile, we hold everyone who attacked you under our command.
Right.
I haven't switched it a little bit more. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Russia. You know, when Russia first went into Syria, started, you know, its Air Force went in what was it, late September, I think, of 2015. There was a lot of the kind of hysteria, but also this a kind of a gloating, I noticed, certainly over here, that Russia had stepped in it and this was going to be the end for Russia and Putin. And it looks, at least, like they've managed, you know, given what they have in their assets, that they've managed it pretty well so far from a purely kind of strategic point of view. How would you assess the success of the Russian mission there? And what's the end game for them, or what's the next step for them?
That's a huge question.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay, no problem. So let's look with a naked eye what Russia did in Syria. At the first beginning of the Syrian war, Russia was a bit numb, like it was in Libya, and didn't want to interfere, didn't want to take part of what's happening. So when the first Russian intervention, real intervention, diplomatic intervention, took place when Obama decided to hit Syria because of the chemical weapons claim in Al Ghouta.
Right. That's September 2013, right?
Yeah. Yes, correct. Mm-hmm. In 2013, Russia moved in politically and played a role between the Americans and the Iranians, really, not with Assad, because Obama had decided to attack Syria. And Iran sent a strong message and called Hezbollah to be ready for a battle and saying, you bomb Damascus, we bomb Tel Aviv. And this is when the Russian interfere and managed to negotiate with the American president about the solution out. And this is when the chemical weapons were delivered and Syria had no longer chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. Now, the second step was in 2015. Meanwhile, Russia kept supplying the Syrian army with weapons and ammunition and whatever the Syrian army needed. Of course, the Russians are very generous. So you pay for one ship, you get two or three for free with it. therefore, that was the policy Russia maintained until 2015. In 2015, the big change happened in Syria, where the Syrian allies, Hezbollah and Iran, understood that it was a lost battle and had no more possibility to defend the rural areas in every city, and decided to retrieve into the main cities. So they said, okay, we can't liberate Syria. It's impossible. The flow of weapons and men is beyond us. We can't liberate the whole country. We will retreat to the main cities and defend the main cities. We're talking about Homs, Hama, Aleppo, Daraa, etc. And this is when the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, General Qasem Soleimani, went to Moscow and met with the Syrian authority, with the Russian authorities, and explained to them that this is a lost battle, and the area that they are in Latakia may fall because Latakia was bombed, and and Turkey helped the Al Qaeda to move into the area of Kasab, north of Latakia, and they reached the sea, they reached the Mediterranean. Al-Qaeda had an access to the sea at that time. And Iran and its allies, along with the Syrian army, was not able to push back these forces. Therefore, they explained to the Russian that their base in Syria, in Latakia and Tartush, will vanish with the end of the power of this Syrian system. And this is when Russia accepted to take part of the war, but in a limited intervention, not in a wide intervention. But I will explain why now. So the first thing that Russia secured was Latakia, and then defended the main city to make sure that these main city were protected. Russia had the phobia and the terror of the Afghan war experience. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to repeat the same problem in Syria. Therefore, they were a bit skeptical about being very much involved on the entire geography as the Iranian and Damascus wanted them to do. Luckily, Turkey came in and shot down the Russian jet.
Right.
And this is where it moved this whole Russian intervention in Syria to a complete dimension. This is where Russia understood that it is its own reputation, its strengths, and its presence in Syria that is under threat, and that Turkey would never give the order to shoot down a jet without the approval of the United States, because from the moment the Russian jet reached the Syrian-Turkish border to the moment of firing the missile against the jet, it took 17 seconds. In 17 seconds, it's impossible to pick up the phone and call the person in charge, mm-hmm. a decision maker, and take an approval to shoot down a Russian jet.
Right.
It was
it had to be done in advance. It was settled in advance.
Right, and that's a NATO thing, so that would be the Americans ultimately.
Exactly, yeah. And Turkey ran immediately under the skirt of NATO and tried to seek protection, but it was clear that nobody's going to create a third world war because of Turkey's decision to send a message to its own rebels in Syria that we're strong and we can protect you and don't worry.
Right.
So this is when Russia went wild against the pro-Turkey forces in Syria, and they immediately started to destroy the Turkish proxy and started to enlarge its intervention to give more push to the Syrian army and to make sure that it is its presence and intervention is a game changer. However, Russia always kept the possibility of negotiation, and to the dislike of Iran and Damascus, accepted to negotiate with the Americans. And the negotiation between John Kerry and Lavrov were honest negotiation from the Russian and the State Department side, but not from the defense secretary, U.S. defense secretary, who wanted the war and didn't want to give up to Russia and wanted Russia to be more involved in Syria and go down to the Syrian quagmire, mm-hmm. and to sink in the problem of Syria for many years to come.
Mm-hmm.
But what the Americans didn't understand is Syria is offering only air force, and instead of using its own budget of defense on their pilots and air force to train them on fictive targets in Russia, they use exactly the same budget in Syria on live targets and with live ammunition, and they managed to sell a whole deal for arms and weapons,
mm-hmm.
and to test their weapons and to be able to modify or to promote their own armament.
In so it's been a profitable deal in many ways. It's advertised
correct.
Russian defense industry products. It's given probably better training than training within Russia would be, and it's enhanced the Russian military's reputation.
Absolutely. And then what the Russia pushed on the ground from the first day, their special forces in Latakia and in other areas. And these were collecting really learning warfare experience against groups they might face one day. And they were observing other groups, how the other groups were fighting, and also taking the lesson from their own power and the coordination with other forces, which is highly complicated and complex on such a vast area of a military theater of 180,000 square kilometers in Syria. And when every time John Kerry presented a good idea for the Russian, bad for the Iranians, the Russian would accept it, to the point that the Russian accepted to ground their own air force and Assad air force in exchange of an honest ceasefire. And because Turkey and the Americans refused, therefore, to the happiness of Iran and Damascus, the war continue until Assad and his allies managed to reach the point they are today, where they are the overwhelming force and they've secured a very large part of Syria.
So the Pentagon was, I mean, I've kind of heard about this, but you're confirming it. The Pentagon was undermining any ceasefire in U.S. diplomacy all along the way. I mean, have you heard about where Obama was on any of that?
Well, Obama agreed with the Pentagon because okay. He wanted to keep a distance also, and he was happy to see Russia sinking in Syria, Iran using all its resources, because Iran is using resources, it's using oil, it's using money, it's using men, and Hezbollah is having over 1,700 killed and 8,000 to 9,000 wounded in the war. So it is an advantage of the United States foreign policy, Israel, and Saudi Arabia to see everybody sinking in Syria, fighting endlessly.
Yes, but it sounds like it has backfired vis-a-vis Russia. It may have been draining, maybe, Hezbollah and Iran to some extent, but it seems like Russia has profited pretty greatly with not much cost so far.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I agree with you. Yes, Russia profited with less than a dozen killed or mm-hmm. 2 dozen killed in a huge war, is fighting from the air, few thousand special forces on the ground, and the whole infantry is run by Iran allies and the Syrian army. So it's just very low cost, really, and it's a great experience, and it has managed to strike a contract for 50 years with the Syrian government about an almost permanent base on the sea, moving its fleet to the Mediterranean. It's a huge benefit. And it has imposed itself as a main player in the Middle East, where it had none before 2015.
Yeah, I saw that there was some poll taken of younger people in the Middle East, Arabs in the Middle East in different countries, and the number of people who saw Russia now as a force for good, or at least a potential ally, has soared. You wouldn't have thought so, because it seemed that that Russia had taken a side in a sectarian war with a minority group. But this is all across even Sunni countries with young people. I was kind of surprised. I can't remember where this, off the top of my head, where this survey was published. I think it was in the Financial Times, but it was kind of surprising how much the prestige and the reputation of Russia had gone up throughout a lot of countries in the Middle East from this. So that means they're going to be seen as a more reliable ally, so their influence is going to be greater, so they're going to be able to sell more weapons and advisors and people to work on those weapons and you know, service them. It does seem to have paid off pretty well, and it seems that
You've touched a very good point. People in the Middle East I talk to, they make huge difference between the Americans, who don't accept or don't have friends, but business partners, and Russian, who go all the way to defend Assad and their friends and partners, unlike the United States. So yes, Russia has gained a lot, particularly keeping away from the Middle Eastern problems, internal conflict. Like, for example, Russia is helping Iran and Hezbollah in Syria, but is not taking part of the Israeli-Iranian-Hezbollah conflict. Mm-hmm. We see mm-hmm. Israel is capable of bombing ammunition and weapon warehouses in Damascus right. without the Russian intervention. And Russian saying, you don't bomb the forces that are attacking ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and you can do whatever you want with your problem with Hezbollah. It's none of our business. But don't bomb Hezbollah where they are fighting Al-Qaeda or ISIS in Syria. Hmm. And that went well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense.
And it's a change from the Soviet Union, which seemed to have a record of abandoning Middle Eastern communist allies in particular. I remember when the Soviet Union abandoned the Egyptian Communist Party, which had been quite strong, and gave its membership to Nasser, who turned on him pretty sharply.
Yeah, agree.
Well, okay, Elijah, thank you very much for this brilliant interview. It's been remarkable, and I hope we can have you on the show again sometime. We really appreciate this. This is a completely original and honest perspective on some stories that get treated very shabbily in most of the media.
Yes, thank you. I agree.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Elijah. And good luck out there.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye.
Okay, that was our interview, great interview, with Elijah Magnier, the chief correspondent and veteran war correspondent, chief correspondent at Al Rai. And you should definitely check out his blog. Just type in, you'll see it, because he publishes all of his articles in English at his blog. It's a WordPress blog. So yeah, his name is Elijah, E-L-I-J-A-H, and the last name is Magnier, M for Mary, A-G-N-I-E-R. And his blog, anyway, the address is elijahjm.wordpress.com. And it's full of just, you know, just really unvarnished, great insights everywhere.
I wish we could have asked him the name of the Washington Post correspondent he talked to, who said, look, I just follow the paper's policy.
Yeah, that was amazing. It's like, you know that that's true, but to hear that it's true, it's pretty stunning.
And to be willing to say that to somebody who's as committed as Elijah clearly is to telling the truth about the region, that's kind of frightening.
Yeah. Yeah. Should have asked. I mean, I was so stunned hearing it. I forgot to even ask who it was. I feel like I have some names in my head.
Do we get three guesses?
I know. So looking back at the interview, I mean, John, what was there anything in particular that surprised you the most? I mean, I have to just say
there were moments where I was thinking, oh my God, I should have realized that.
Like, yeah.
When he pointed out the logistical enormity of sustaining this large conventional war with a supposedly homegrown guerrilla movement for year after year, when by comparison, as he said, Israel had to call the U.S. for massive resupply efforts after 30 days of war with Hezbollah. That's something that I've never heard mentioned. And once you hear it, you think, oh my God, that's obvious. Mm-hmm. But I've never heard anybody mention that. So as he said, it's very clear that the Sunni militias have been getting massive nonstop resupply efforts through Turkey.
But it's also just clear, I mean, it's not just the stories that are published that are propaganda, but what's not published. And the fact that no journalist in the West has really looked into why. How do they get resupplied like that? Why are they able to go on all this time? The fact that it's not a constant story as itself, I mean, is really the biggest propaganda part of the Syria war. And, you know, the answer is because it's deeply embarrassing. It shows that it's our allies. It's our allies that are, you know, arming and funding and supplying these al-Qaeda radical Salafist groups.
And in large part, it might have been our own state that was doing it because, I mean, the sense I get is the United States state isn't really totally unified about what's happening in Syria. And there are a lot, you know, there's, as somebody mentioned proudly, 17 intelligence agencies, and they all have secret budgets that would make most people faint. So there's a lot of opportunity to freelance, even if you don't have central state clearance.
Yeah. And again, we sort of knew that, I didn't quite realize he seemed to speak pretty highly of Kerry, which I hadn't heard much of that before, but that Kerry was making these deals and then the Pentagon with sort of Obama's quiet blessing was undermining him at every step. I mean, I like the way that he described what happened when the U.S. coalition accidentally bombed for several hours.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he put that into good context there, why it's so absolutely absurd that, you know, it was an accident.
And then his whole explanation of the United States project in southern and eastern Syria is something I've never heard mentioned before. Yeah. And it makes a horrible kind of sense.
And it also kind of remarkably stupid, too. I mean, it sounds, he's pretty sure, and he's been there for a while, that it's pretty doomed.
Yeah.
So it doesn't sound like they really know what they're doing. I think, you know, it's sort of like in a big corporation, I forget what they call it, sort of a bureaucratic inertia, I guess they call it, where you get so used to the idea that, you know, this chaos that we've sown there, it sort of seems to work for everybody we care about. They don't really seem to know how to move to the next stage where it seems like the Russians and the SAA and the Iranians, they've been thinking about the next stage for quite a long time. But it doesn't seem like we've really thought about the post, or the Israelis, as he said. They're not really
the analogy to the Israelis is really good there. Like they're thinking, all right, we can mess these people up for another 5 years or maybe 10 years, but what happens then?
Yeah. And it seems like while we're thinking about that, other people are already making plans on how to actually consolidate power and bring things under control. I could see how Idlib can be very useful as well. I mean, it's going to be a controlling rod, as you've called it, right? Or that's what people are believing anyway, that Idlib is going to be this big, hot, scary region, and it can be a controlling rod to weaken or influence Syria and some areas in the region. Like Chechnya was sort of that up until the early 2000s. And it was very useful, if you look at the broader geopolitics of that region, it was very useful in getting control of the Caspian Sea, of the pipelines that went out of the Caspian Sea for all the oil and gas. It kept Russia focused away from the action for a while.
Yeah, but as he said, this is Syria. These are mostly urban, cosmopolitan people, and they're really not going to tolerate being subjected to this sort of bizarre, reactionary fantasy land in the interests of some outside power.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so cynical. And he, again, Elijah really very well sort of laid out the really stark, savage cynicism of all of these groups playing with Syria, like, you know, the proverbial chessboard pieces. But it's just, it's a really cynical, brutal logic that's going on there. It's
I mean, you want to send the Americans a message and you kill. That's what it comes down to. You kill some of their proxies, only while you're killing them as American proxies, but they exist as individuals in their own right. They just don't count as such in the message that's sent.
And one last thing, and then we'll try and move on to the British election. But, you know, if we already didn't think that Erdogan was a bumbling, stupid, it's never good to call somebody stupid who's in power. I get that. But he really, it's like this guy has screwed up so many times, but he's brutal enough to keep expanding his own power. But the idea of, you know what, I'll shoot down a Russian plane and just check it out and see what happens. You know, I'll send them a message. And it, I mean, if anything backfired more than anything, it was shooting down that Russian plane. I mean, Turkey seems like it's been in retreat from their, you know, Syria project ever since then.
Well, all this stuff plays well with his red state base, but it doesn't play well with anybody else. That's a problem you get with some showboating authoritarian figures who are very good at stirring up the crowd, but not at self-discipline or thinking a few moves ahead. And you know, we had Flint Arthur talking about what happened when the Turkish security people attacked a crowd of protesters in Washington, D.C. It's now pretty clear that Erdogan ordered that. Mm-hmm. And that is not a smart move. Part of being a serious person on the world stage is gritting your teeth and tolerating that sort of insolence from people you might like to kill. If you want them killed, you do it quietly, you know, and you make it look like they happen to get mugged on the way home or something. You don't send your security out to swarm them with everybody filming it on their cell phone. That's just amateur night.
How that played in red state Turkey.
Oh yeah, in red state Turkey, it's great, but he has other audiences to think about. He's not very good at that.
No, I mean, even John McCain, who clearly wants to cut every deal possible with Turkey, was openly furious about that. And yeah, yammered something or other about it. So, speaking of McCain, I just have to say real quickly that, so McCain, I don't know if you saw this in the hearing, with the Comey hearing this week. It was like somebody slipped him some LSD or something.
I didn't see it, but I heard about it. I saw some nice memes, I have to admit. Do you know the Muffin Man?
Do you know the Muffin? Yeah. What was funny is then Putin came out and said, oh, come on. I know that we're on opposite sides, but I actually like the guy. He's a true patriot. Cut him some slack, you know. So he did he was the better man, Putin, in this situation. And then everyone in Washington, the reporters, got really angry that Putin did that. And they said, oh, that's the biggest trolling I've ever seen. But, you know, if you know Russia and you certainly know these kind of FSB macho patriot types, I actually don't think he was completely BS. He knew that he was kind of twisting the knife a little bit in McCain by taking the high road with him. But at the same time, it's actually true. These guys are much more comfortable with military intelligence conservatives sitting across from them than with liberals.
McCain
liberals.
Is not a chicken hawk.
Yeah. And
I mean, if you're from a macho state culture like that, the fact that he did his duty. As somebody pointed out, he didn't volunteer to be a prisoner. He volunteered to bomb people, but he ended up a prisoner, and you know, he went through all that, and he has us, in his terms, a sort of straightforward American nationalist agenda. Yeah, it's very easy to see those people feeling
they get it. And I think also, you know, you can handle also losing a few moves to a guy like that. But, these guys, these FSB guys are, they can't handle losing to a liberal. They couldn't handle losing to a black guy or a woman. You know, it's just, that's reality. So
the other high school aspect of this too, which, having been severely and humiliatingly bullied in high school, I can tell you that the worst moment is where somebody, one of the decent alpha types, intervenes and says, oh, come on, leave him alone.
Exactly.
That's when it hurts the worst.
Yes, yes. No, I agree. He definitely was twisting the knife there at that moment, because McCain, yeah, he never misses a moment to trash Putin as, you know, the Satan, basically, you know. So, right. So, speaking of Satan, Corbyn almost won. To speak of real Satan, let's speak about Theresa May and the Conservatives' new coalition allies, the DUP. Out here, I don't think anybody quite knows who they are. They're basically the political arm of Northern Ireland's KKK, right?
The political wing of the UDA, UVF, yeah. UFF, basically the loyalist death squads or paramilitaries, whatever you want to call them, who specialized in retaliatory attacks, just driving into the nearest so-called Catholic neighborhood or, let's say, nationalist neighborhood and shooting the first three random people they saw. It's astonishing. And basically, I'm sure everybody knows this, but anyway, the Conservatives did very badly in the election. They were 20 points ahead when May did the brilliant strategic move of calling an election. They ended up winning by only 7%, I think, which means they came about 8 seats short of a majority, and the other minority parties are like the Scottish National Party, the Liberal Democrats, even Sinn Féin, which abstains. It won 7 seats, but none of those people attend Parliament. That policy goes back more than a century. So the only right-wing party for the Tories to ally with was the DUP, which is Democratic Unionist Party. Older viewers probably know the name Ian Paisley. If you don't, you can watch quite a good skit by Harry Enfield called William Ulsterman. He does a really good imitation of Ian Paisley going from zero to complete insane sectarian rage over not being offered cheddar cheese and pineapple on a cracker at a party. And that's pretty much what the DUP is about. This is the voice of the most insane, loathsome, Ulster papist-hating faction of all. I mean, it was created in 1971 because Paisley, a classic demagogue and a very impressive one in some ways, a minister of the Free Presbyterian Church, which is not the Presbyterian Church on your corner of your suburb in America. The Free Presbyterian Church is pure 17th century Calvinist sectarian hate.
Well, I have to say there's some of that in Presbyterianism here in America as well, which I guess is directly linked to that. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, people like Gary North and some of these like Christian Reconstructionists, they're in Presbyterian, or their churches are called the Presbyterian this or that. And, you know, these are guys who believe in stoning for adultery and stoning gays and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, I'm not fully up with what American Presbyterians believe, although the people across the street were Presbyterian, but they were Minnesota Presbyterians. They were pretty nice about it. Still, they had the mild sort of anti-Catholicism. I have a friend who grew up Southern Baptist, and he had the much more extreme version, which was, he says he remembers when he was a kid, and Baptists thought abortion was totally fine. They had no problem with it. They thought Catholics opposed abortion as part of a plan to flood America with brown Mexican babies.
Right.
And that there actually were secret tunnels under Catholic churches and all that.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's some of that in America, but it's more of a curiosity. I mean, his grandfather actually believed the earth was flat at the same time, and I don't think, you know, that was going to last too many more generations. But it
Yeah, they're not so powerful. They're still a minor part of the Presbyterians here, but he was the representative of the Ulster loyalists there, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, basically the whole population is a settler population. It was It was planted there in order to terrorize the natives, and it took that mission seriously. Sectarianism allowed it to keep the mission going without infection, and that was something that the people who planted that population, it was called the Ulster Plantation, it was something they designed, they built in, because previous immigrants, conqueror immigrants to Ireland, had become, as the cliche had it, more Irish than the Irish, like the Norman aristocrats who took over Ireland became absurdly Irish, as the English saw it. They didn't understand what had happened. They wanted to make sure that wouldn't happen again. So when they sent these people from Scotland to the province of Ulster in Northern Ireland, they sent them there because Ulster was the most dangerous province. It was the one with the longest record of rebellion against English rule. And they sent people who were pure products of the climate of the 30 Years' War, let's say, the early 17th century. They became in the U.S. the Scots-Irish, if you want to think about that. They moved to the southern U.S. and moved inland quickly, and they became, you know, Andrew Jackson's people. Mm-hmm. But there's a great book about them. There's a bad book that's really popular right now by that Senator Jim Webb guy called Born Fighting, and it's like, aren't we great because we're so pugnacious and we like NASCAR and I don't know, a lot of crap. But there's a much better book simply called The Scots-Irish, which was published in 1989. And, the author's name, I should know this. It's, James Leyburn, The Scotch-Irish, A Social History. This book doesn't get read as much, but it's a much better book, published in 1989. What Leyburn says very pithily and sadly is that the Scotch-Irish were sort of distilled as a consciousness after the horrific sectarian violence of the 30 Years' War era, but before the Enlightenment transformed parts of Scotland. Mm. So they were in time for the bad stuff and not in time for the good stuff, unfortunately. And they moved to Ulster first, and then because the English were too stodgy for them, they moved on to the U.S. But not all moved on to the U.S. The ancestors of Ian Paisley and the DUP stayed in Ulster, and after the rest of Ireland became independent around 1920, many others from the south moved up there. So you got a population sort of like the French in Algeria, who were embittered further by defeat and had started out pretty damn bitter. So the DUP was created in 1971 because of Paisley's feeling that the other Ulster Unionist parties were not reacting violently enough to the civil rights struggle that was carried out by the, I hate to say Catholics, because, you know, if you think people in Sinn Féin or the IRA are like weekly mass goers, that's just wrong. They tend to be rather leftist. But
it's the only way I think people would quite know, I think, because
I don't know what else to call it. They call themselves nationalists,
right.
But the thing about sectarian identity, it doesn't mean that if you get killed for being a Shia, they chose you because they noticed that you were particularly pious in your observance of Ashura. It just means you have that kind of name, you come from that kind of neighborhood, that's your sectarian identity. Mm-hmm. We don't care what you believe about God, you just belong to that community. And that's how sectarian identity works. We've talked about this before. It's more like what Americans imagine as a racial or an ethnic group than a purely religious difference. It's not like people stand around arguing about religion in sectarian divides.
Right.
They felt that the more genteel middle-class representatives of the loyalist or Protestant community were not decisive enough. They were not willing to say quite as loudly as they once had that the Pope was the Antichrist, which Ian Paisley once said at a meeting of, actually when some Pope or other was addressing the European Assembly, Paisley, who had a voice that could be heard for miles, stood up and yelled, "You are the Antichrist!"
Wow.
Which must have puzzled a bunch of cynical Belgians and urbane Italians. but anyway, that sort of gives you a sense of these people. That they're not on the same time zone as the rest of the people in the UK. And they have this massive
crush. You all these Europeans in the parliament at the time were sort of wincing and making sure not to look at him because they're afraid, you know, if I make eye contact with him, he may come close to me and start yelling in my face or something. So
he might have. He said that there was a seat numbered 666 in the assembly and that was personally reserved by these socialist continentals for Satan himself.
Wow.
I mean, Paisley was never shy. These people were never shy. And that was their raison d'etre. That was their definition. We're not ashamed to be the Protestant people of Ulster. And you know, there's a tremendous amount of self-pity and self-worship in this. I remember one of them saying, like the children of Israel, the Protestant people of Ulster have not a friend in the world. And you know, with such groups, it never occurs to ask, why is that?
Well, also, well, what about that country next door that, you know, I mean, they may not like you much, but they put you in power, for Christ's sake.
No, that's exactly how it is. They may not like you, but they're useful. I mean, I think, to be fair to Theresa May, which is a weird thing to do, but I'll do it anyway, I doubt she likes these people either. But the interesting thing about the mainstream British reaction to the DUP becoming Theresa May's coalition partners is that nobody focuses on the hate. Nobody focuses on the fact that their representatives, their leaders, are on record as saying Irish or Catholic people are vermin to be extirpated, which they do believe. They focus on the fact, oh, they're climate change deniers or
homophobia.
Yeah, they're not in favor of gay marriage. And if you know these people, you're listening to this like climate change, gay rights. These are people from the 30 Years' War. Don't you understand that?
They're carrying pikes and, you know, they're wearing helmets and you're talking about climate change and these are time travelers.
Yeah, they're washing their hands in the village pump saying, well, we had to do it and it's make life. And you're worrying about climate change. So
I have to read this tweet here. This captured pretty well. I think she's either from Ireland or Britain, Angela Nagel, but she says, it's just, here's the tweet. It says, DUP standing there head to toe in Union Jacks. Britain, quote, I'm sorry, have we met?
Yeah, that drives them crazy too, because the British find them a distasteful, necessary ally. And there's a lot of resentment towards the community they persecute. Although that's really uneven too. I mean, British political demographics are very tricky.
Well, I mean, that's because some of these headlines, she just did a screenshot of different headlines from the British press. Here's the Telegraph. Who are the DUP and will they demand a soft Brexit to prop up the Tories? The Independent. DUP, who are the Democratic Unionist Party?
Yeah.
That could, I mean, this is crazy.
There's been a lot of denial going on. A lot of purposeful avoidance of the kind of distasteful allies that you make in a dirty counterinsurgency like this. You're always going to end up with the sickest death squad people. And, you know, that's not just Ireland. That applies many, many yes. places. And the British press has colluded pretty openly in hiding that fact. I mean, Sammy Wilson is one of the most quotable of the DUP representatives. If you just want to look up Sammy Wilson quotes, you'll find the kind of mentality of the DUP. He describes Sinn Féin voters as subhuman animals. He once said about a plan that was developed in the late 1990s. So this is not long ago. It's not the Ur Dummheit idea where you say, oh, long ago people were all crazy and stupid. No. This was 1994. So in January 1994, the UDA, Ulster Defence Association, a loyalist, so-called death squad, very closely connected to the DUP, and I'm quoting now from his page, the UDA released a document calling for ethnic cleansing and repartition of Ireland with the goal of making Northern Ireland wholly Protestant. The plan was to be implemented should the British Army withdraw from Northern Ireland. Some areas with strong Catholic nationalist majorities near the border would be handed over to the 26-county Republic of Ireland, and those Catholics left stranded in the Protestant state, that's a quote, would be, quote, expelled, nullified, or interned, end quote. Hmm. That was the plan. Nullified is an interesting phrase. Mm. You know, there are so many of these mellifluous euphemisms floating around, but I think it's pretty clear what nullified means. Controversially, Wilson, who has been, among other things, a minister in the cabinet and is at the moment a member of parliament for the DUP, Wilson called some parts of the plan a, quote, very valuable return to reality, end quote. He added, quote, it shows that some loyalist paramilitaries are looking ahead and contemplating what needs to be done to maintain our separate Ulster identity, end quote. So that's the DUP, and they're not shy about it. They're not embarrassed about it, and they don't get much flack for it. Even now, the problem you hear with the DUP, as I said, is like climate change, gay marriage, all this stuff that comes from the 21st century. The real problem with the DUP comes straight out of the 17th century, and not the good part either. Not you know, the Descartes part of the 17th century, but the sack of whole cities, the massacre of whole cities in sectarian warfare.
Right. So, and there's also something else going on here. I mean, people are talking about the fact that this could actually endanger a pretty shaky, particularly in the last year, peace agreement in Northern Ireland by bringing the DUP in. It's, you know, anything is possible out there. And if they're bringing them in the coalition for the first time, who knows what sort of demands they might make, or if Sinn Féin or the Nationalists might walk out. I mean, it's been... Their local rural government has been on ice for a while. There was a big scandal. I haven't followed all this. I was just reading up on a bit. But there was a big corruption scandal. And so Sinn Féin said, you know, until this DUP leader who was caught red-handed in some kind of big, it's called the
cash. Arlene Foster.
Right, the cash for ash scandal. So nobody even questions that it was a big corruption scandal. And Sinn Féin said, you know, until this is dealt with, we're not going to be part of this government. And Theresa May has just ignored it all this time. And
well, that's what's going on in the UK. It's not that they endorse this sectarian craziness, although there are, again, the UK is a complicated society and there are pockets of the old hatreds. But in general, no, they don't endorse this. It's just a... Yeah, they'd rather ignore it than deal with
unless it's to smear Corbyn as an IRA lover, right?
Yeah.
I mean, a ridiculous irony. Corbyn, that was one of the ways they tried to go after him. He you know, supported the IRA. And then the next thing you know, Theresa May's forming a coalition government with terrorists.
Yeah, I mean, that's based on a very false equivalence that we probably don't mm-hmm. even have time to get into. But the idea one's as bad as the other is always a really flaccid position, and it almost never works out. The IRA was a defensive organization. The reason it's the PIRA, the Provisional IRA, is that people were getting burnt out of their houses, their neighborhoods were being destroyed, and the leadership in Dublin decided that it wouldn't be dialectically appropriate to dig up the guns and defend these places. So they said, the hell with you, we're going to defend them anyway. That's why it was provisional. It was not like they decided to hate their neighbors. Their neighbors decided to hate them and decided it was, in fact, their whole reason for existing was to hate and keep down the Tags, the vermin, the mere Irish, whatever you call them. I mean, I'm not willing to pretend that these are equivalent groups.
They're not. I mean, this yeah. is, you know, it's, I don't think people know that the KKK, which is very similar kind of the DUP crowd, but the KKK was, especially I think in the early 20th century, was violently anti-Catholic, probably more anti-Catholic than almost anything. They weren't particularly anti-Semitic at that time. They did get that way later. And they were obviously anti-Black, but I think they were as anti-Catholic, if, in some areas more anti-Catholic than anti-Black, depending on the region they were in.
There have been lots of attempts to make America a sectarian society on the model of Northern Ireland. There are a lot of reasons, again, too many to get into now, that didn't work out, but it was certainly the goal of the KKK and a lot of other groups. There is no equivalence. And for that matter, the current UK press isn't even making an equivalence.
No.
It's like IRA bad, DUP, you know, they have some funny views about climate change.
Yeah, but I guess this would just kind of segue back into the Corbyn election and what happened with him. I mean, the press, you know, I mean, first of all, he only lost, or Labour only lost by about 2% points in the popular vote. But of course, right. This is about constituents, is a parliamentary republic. So it's not a republic, I'm sorry. It's a parliamentary system. So it's sort of constituency by constituency. But overall, you know, their popular vote rose from 30 to 40%. And the Conservatives got, I think, 42%. And he did this by running populist left, by rather than kind of the neoliberal shtick that keeps failing and failing, by going much more of a populist left, and it was very successful and surprised everyone, especially in the media. And you know, it was really surprising. I mean, there were all these stories planted, including some very familiar sounding ones. There was one in the Telegraph a few days ago, just before the election, unnamed, you know, MI6 source who asked that his name not be used, said that the Secret Service has been following Corbyn for 20 years as a subversive who was out to destroy democracy. I mean, they did everything to try to smear and tarnish him. And I'm wondering, some people asked, well, you know, had The Guardian, for example, which is supposed to be the left-wing newspaper, but which ran a relentlessly vicious campaign, you know, against Corbyn, not just during the election, but going back at least a year. Corbyn is destroying Labour. Corbyn is destroying the left. The left is suicidal. Turns out they were wrong. Incredibly wrong. And at the very last second, literally 2 or 3 days before the election, The Guardian suddenly turned on a dime and said, "We've loved this guy all along. You know, we're with you, Jeremy." I'm almost wondering, though, if the, it's sort of like with, you know, here we're at a point where the whole establishment ganging up, including the kind of putative left, is ganging up on this guy, helped him. I mean, if it's anything like what happened here, I would think some were asking, well, what if The Guardian had actually supported Corbyn? He might have been able to flip those, you know, few thousand votes and actually had a majority. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe the fact that everyone who's against him, everyone in the establishment was against him, and people are are, for legitimate reasons, very anti-establishment right now. The establishment's failing large numbers of people, so it's hard to say.
Yeah, I mean, I've said before that I read comment threads. I think they're really fascinating, and Guardian threads are one of those I read. And even Guardian readers are mad at the Guardian most of the time. They have this strong, and because they're middle-class English people, very articulate sense that the journal is going in the wrong direction, just like the whole political culture is going in the wrong direction. So I think that's quite plausible. They might have liked Corbyn because newspapers, even the ones they felt some sort of vestigial allegiance to, didn't like Corbyn.
Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of something too, because you know, the Western press corps that operates in Russia and Ukraine, I mean, in the 90s, you know, of course, this was a big thing in the exile. In the 90s and early 2000s, all these guys were kind of standard neoliberal hacks. But at least you could say at that time that there was kind of one ideology in the world. It was so dominant, the kind of the neoliberal, maybe neoconservative ideology that was... After the collapse of the Soviet Union and America kind of stood alone, it was quite dominant. So, you know, even though we obviously bash these people for taking these assumptions and placing it over Russia and disastrously, nevertheless, it seemed to make a little bit more sense. But what I've noticed is, you know, you have the press corps that has one ideology, and then they... And that ideology now does not really comport with where most people are in their country. Mm-hmm. And so they're seeing Russia through this frame, Russia and Ukraine through this frame. I mean, I just went back and looked at some of these guys, Oliver Bulla, who's actually, you know, maybe not so bad, Oliver Carroll, who's can be bad. A lot of these Western correspondents who work out there, and they're always very righteously angry at Russia, righteously angry at something goes on there. Like, they're just always so outraged, you know? And then you read their tweets, they're also incredibly outraged at Corbyn. And it just reminded me again that these people, it's a very narrow selection. Very little diversity. These people probably celebrate diversity all the time and attack anyone who's against diversity. But actually, ideological diversity, there's no ideological diversity in the Western press corps in a place like, you know, Russia and Ukraine among Western hacks there. And I'm sure it's the case in the Middle East. In fact, it may just be the case overall that the media does come from a pretty narrow ideological strand. And they're... And that, again, might be less shocking or objectionable in a different time, but their ideological assumptions are now rejected by most people. So they're coming from a real minority elitist ideological assumption.
Not just minority, but hostile. I mean, one of the differences between that time when they were caricaturing Russia and now is that at that time they didn't caricature their own countries in the same hostile way. They do now. After Trump won, they caricature America in a very hostile way, as if they were looking at, you know, an enemy state. And you just sent me today that article by our old friend James Kirchick of Mauritania, Beacon of Democracy fame.
Hail Mauritania.
Hail Mauritania, land of the brave and free.
Yeah.
Anyway, so... Yeah, you sent me this thing that Jamie Kirchick published in the LA Times, if I recall today, which said, too much democracy. That's what Corbyn's win proves. And there was, you know, there was this hint throughout that that's what Trump proves also, that democracy is bad because it puts power in the hands of a bunch of horrible dummies, and we can't have that. And there's been more and more of that right now, which is truly remarkable coming from, I mean, I'm willing to deal with elitism. I used to be an academic, and any academic who says they're not an elitist is taking money under false pretenses. But anyway, an elite should be an elite. I mean, for God's sake, not James Kirchick of Mauritania boosting thing.
I know. Yeah, get out of here. You're stinking up the elite room. You know, we don't want, he doesn't belong in the elite, but he certainly thinks so. But no, what he wrote has been a recurring theme among, really what it is, it's among people who share a narrow ideology that's hostile and that sees the world around them as increasingly hostile, because it is. They're not popular, they're not liked, and they want to hold on to their jobs and their power that, you know, having their media jobs gives them. And so they're lashing out. But, you know, there was the big article by Andrew Sullivan, which went back to Plato for some stupid reason to explain why too much democracy is bad. Plato, of course, was also kind of the godfather of totalitarianism, but that's another story. I think Robert Kagan, I think, published something like that in the Washington Post. Also, too much democracy is bad. By the way, Kagan, this is just slightly side note, but there was an article today in Politico by Jamie Rubin, who used to be the press spokesman for Clinton. I remember during the Kosovo War and sort of the late Clinton years, he was the press spokesman for the State Department then. And he just published an article. He was in the Hillary Clinton campaign. He was a surrogate for her. And he published an article today saying, who's afraid of Jeremy Corbyn? Me, that's who. And he went on to call Jeremy Corbyn, of course, a Russian useful idiot and stooge and all this kind of, you know, just Russia baited him. But I looked up what he's doing. I thought, well, what's he doing these days, Jamie Rubin? Well, it turns out that he was the, do I have this in my notes here? He's the co-chair of a group. Oh, where the hell do I have this? Unfortunately, anyway, it's a group with Robert Kagan, the neocon, and it is called. Oh, here I have it. The group that he is a co-chair of in D.C. It's called the Extending American Power for the Center for a New American Security Group.
Does that spell something? Because otherwise it's the worst name in the world.
It's unbelievable. I think it's sort of like, let's pile on every neocon imperial, you know, cliche we can, and then, you know, build up a big letterhead and get some Saudis funding this or something. I don't know. But that's where he comes from. I mean, they're all worried that Corbyn is just going to be bad for weapon sales, pretty much. And, you know, and
of course, for those of us who are Americans living abroad, the obvious implication of Corbyn's win is, you see, Democrats, you could have stood for something and won instead of standing for nothing at all and losing. But that doesn't seem to be getting through either.
Well, it actually kind of does, because some people who are pretty active on social media, people like Joan Walsh, who was the editor of Salon for a long time now I think she's at The Nation. Big-time Hillary surrogate, she had a meltdown on Twitter. I can't stand anymore hearing these Bernie bros saying Bernie would have won. We got to do something about it. I want to burn them all. And you're just having an absolute meltdown over it because I think they know now it's true. I think it's actually a little bit different. If Bernie had wanted to win, he would have beat Hillary and he would have beat Trump. But I still believe, and I even have that on pretty good information. Bernie never went into it to win. Corbyn clearly wants to win. He doesn't seem like the kind of guy who could win. I have to admit, it surprised me.
No, when you told me about intelligence agencies trailing him for 20 years, I was wondering, like, did any of them hang themselves out of boredom?
Yeah, I know. It seems... He does seem like a very unlikely character, and he seems like somebody familiar. I feel like I've seen him around campus, and does not seem threatening at all. And he's got great politics. I mean, I don't know. I'd be happy to give it a try.
Yeah, but, no, he seems wonderful, but he doesn't seem like a very lurid figure. He doesn't seem like he would repay J. Edgar Hoover's time if they had a team following him around. I hear he makes jam. Oh, God. We got him now. We got him on the jam.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, maybe that's why all of these reports trying to smear him. Because for so long, again, this is the media. For a year and a half, they were saying, he's a loser, he's a loser, he's bad, he's going to lose. And then all of a sudden, on a dime, when it looks like he actually might upset Theresa May in one way or her plans or ruin her majority, it just turned from, he's actually incredibly dangerous. We've always known he's dangerous. He is, you know, he's Ming the Evil. I mean, it was so it wasn't a really believable story. And you know, you're finding the same kind of stories being planted here by it's like they're working out of the same black PR propaganda book, and with very similar media assets. They're just I don't know. They seem to be just toying with the public's minds, and it doesn't seem to be working as well as they think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if James Kirchick is a sample, like, I go with the they're not very bright.
Thing. Yeah.
Because when you know a few of those people, I mean, maybe some of them made it on merit, but a lot of there are other skills involved, schmoozing and the longing for consensus and the longing to be part of something. Those take you a long way in the world that we come from.
That's true. I mean, the real brains are in big corporate law firms and investment banks. I mean, I'm sorry, it's true. And they're being used for ill there for the most part. Yeah. But they are. And, you know, and even somebody like Comey, maybe Comey was on paper fairly smart. But watching him, I just couldn't help get the feeling that this guy is the ultimate save my ass, you know, player in Washington. Everything he does is designed to cover his ass and save his ass. He leaves a note here. He meets with this guy. He does a favor for the Republicans against Hillary. He does a favor for the Democrats and McCain against Trump. Like, he's a guy who's just the consummate Washington, D.C., you know, scumbag. I mean, I just find people like that gross. I don't know what's to love about this guy. People are holding him up like he's a
Well,
hero.
Yeah, we're supposed to love some strange people, like every single one of our 17 intelligence agencies, apparently.
I know. Exactly. Okay. And on that intelligent note, I think we could wrap it up. And again, thanks again to Elijah Magnier for a great interview. And thanks to all of our subscribers for supporting the show. Bye, John.
Bye, Mark.